Thank you all for coming, and we're going to have, I guess, a conversation a little bit about Will Eisner, why he's still relevant, what makes someone relevant, perhaps, and what it is about the whole process of preserving the legacy of an important creative person in comics and otherwise. I'm Paul Levitz. Joining me today, I have Jackie Estrada on my immediate left, who is the longtime administrator of the Eisner Awards, which is certainly the most broadest.
Ooh. Really, you're a professional writer.
This has been too long a day already. The broadest reach of anything bearing Will's name that continues to come out. Beyond her, we have Maggie Thompson, sometimes referred to as the dead mother of comics fandom, other times referred to by things she would more like to be referred to by, but one of the great keepers of the faith and the knowledge and history of the field. And beyond her, we have Paul Dini, who these days is perhaps best known or blamed for being the co-creator of Harley Quinn. Sort of named in a very Will Eisner kind of fashion, now that I think about that.
Yeah.
And has a few qualities in common with the characters that Will liked to portray as his women. A little more modern incarnation, but Will was very fond of murderous women. Not necessarily in his personal life. As far as I know, Anne was never accused of murder. But in his professional life. So let's chat. So the operant question, when you create anything culturally, story, art, video, creativity tends to have a cultural half-life. There's the rare thing like Shakespeare's works that we still talk about and we still read 400 odd years later. But that happens very rarely. Part of what makes cultural work effective and exciting is its links to the culture of the moment. What captures the zeitgeist? Is Frozen cooler as a Disney movie than its predecessors because, for whatever reason, girl empowerment is a theme of the day? And with any luck at all, X years from now, all the girls will already be in power, and it won't necessarily be quite as unique and exciting as it was in that moment. Or maybe at least all the Disney girls will be in power. I can be optimistic about this, can't I, Jack?
I thought everybody already was. So. You just don't know it yet.
The women in my life certainly are, and the ladies on this panel, I would not doubt. But notwithstanding. So there's a challenge. If you showed up here, I think it's a safe bet, as Jackie earlier said to me, that you already know why Will was important. But importance is a little different from relevance. Right, we know Will was important because he added to the creative vocabulary of comics, because people are continuing to use techniques that he pioneered, because he taught generations of people who were continuing to create new and important creative work on a daily basis. But that's not quite the same thing as relevance. What does being relevant as a creative person mean to each of you as you look at people's work? And what is it about Will's specific body of work that you think makes the work and the man still relevant? This is a trick question because I have not prepared anyone for it.
So there's so many different ways you could answer that, because you could talk about his relevance as things that he did behind the scenes that nobody knows about, where he was a businessman, and so how he made a point of owning his own work very early when everybody else was working for hire has great relevance today, because that became what separated people who were able to own their own works and guide whatever happened to them between those who did great things for a company that then said, okay, we're going to give that to somebody else and you're not associated with it anymore and goodbye. So I think that is one aspect that has continued relevance, even though not that many people are really aware of that side of Will as the businessman, that once you got to know him and saw what his background was, that he always thought of what the business aspects were. But one other thing that I'll point out is that when he went to do a graphic novel, he said, I don't want this to be something that's just aimed at comics people. I want to do something that will be published by a regular publisher that'll be in bookstores and regular people can buy, and it's not just for a very narrow audience who know who Will Eisner is and they're just going to buy Will Eisner stuff. So I think that is another aspect that inspired a lot of people to realize we have such a wider audience for the kinds of things that can be done in this medium.
I think the question of relevance versus the tangled web of history is something to the point here. So if you say he's relevant because he did the creator ownership, the businessman, that's one aspect. Another aspect is his diversification of the art form. So probably in another 100 years, nobody is going to sit around unless they keep this panel forever online. Nobody's going to say, you know what, he went to the Army and said, here's a way to use comic books to train your mechanics. And here's a paperback publisher that's going to do a series of comics illustrated books on ghosts, for example. He did a whole bunch of oddball paperbacks for the mainstream audience long before the graphic novel material that he did. Also, the skilled use of the collaborative creators. So while, yes, he got to keep the rights to the spirit, we have Jules Feiffer over here and Wally Wood over there and Lou Fine and so forth, all of whom labored without credit unless sneaked in sometimes, because we saw that there's a... It has bewildered me that the collection of spirit sections that DC did, the cover of one of them is a gag that is never explained in the book, in which Jules Feiffer's character, which was a backup page in the spirit sections, takes over the strip. Specifically, Jules Feiffer conks Eisner on the head at the end of the year when there's a summary of what has happened in the year in spirit. And so his character is the character throughout the summary and plays the spirit throughout that item. And we once had a letter from someone who said there wouldn't have been a Mad magazine without the spirit. And I think that's a fair point. So there's all kinds of relevance and influence and so forth that we will never grasp all of. Long, tedious.
Maggie, you made an excellent point. I was just talking to a few writers about the career of about the realities of having a career as a writer. And a couple of them were bemoaning the fact that there doesn't seem to be the stability for writers that perhaps there once was in comics or television or anything that years ago you could do one type of writing and that would be your career, or work on one strip and everything. And with the landscape for employment changing so radically, that I think that there's an incredible amount relevance to looking at the way Will structured his career, especially in regards to the Army training manuals and the later graphic novels. I think Will is, you know, will always be known for the spirit and for a relatively small body of his work in comparison to the rest of his career. But you look at that was just the opening act, and then he went on and found ways to diversify his artwork and his storytelling. And that when he entered into the later phase of his life, he basically founded the graphic novel with A Contract with God and Signal from Space and a lot of other things that are really tremendous works, and they are among the finest works of graphic literature. And I think that over time those will endure, and that more attention will be paid to the man himself and the way he lived, and he'll go on and certainly be an example and an inspiration as far as that goes.
So I'm trying to pull this together a little and expand on it, perhaps. A lot of good points raised. So I'm hearing that part of the continuing relevance is the man himself. Paul was really very specific about that. And I think that's very true for many of us working in comics. Will's personal behavior, personal approach to the field, serves as a very inspiring role model. And that's something that I think the awards has tried to preserve and present to the world. I think it was something that was one of the unspoken or unidentified goals of the book I did on Will, Champion of the Graphic Novel. This was a creative person who kept learning and kept changing. And it is an enormous challenge for us. As Paul says, you rarely get to write in only one media form for a lifetime. Like, you almost never get to draw in one media form and successfully make a living for a lifetime. How do you adapt? How do you change? Will is a great role model, a great story of how to be a grown-up and how to manage through all of those changes. Another piece of the puzzle, though, in terms of the relevancy, I think I suggest we step back a little from the very specific things that each of the four of us have said so far and talk about the times we're living in. We are in an era of burgeoning visual communication. It is 30 years past the beginning of desktop publishing, the beginning of most of the technologies that make a wider range of visual communication possible. And the young people, not only of America, but of the world, are beginning to communicate visually more than they ever have. Whether you look at that in terms of emojis or Instagram, people are using imagery to tell their stories personally in a way that really wasn't possible a generation ago. You can't point to Will pioneering that in the way that you can talk about his role with the graphic novel, but you can certainly point to the diversity of the way Will used visual communication commercially, not just the Army, but the many, many commercial clients, the many kinds of teaching, the many kinds of books that were mentioned. He was constantly exploring how to communicate ideas and story visually. He did several of the first books on the subject long before Scott got around to understanding comics. We're living in a world that is going to be dominated by these tools. And when the academic scholars look back and say, who saw this coming? Who started to talk about the language of visual communication? It's not going to be uniquely Will, because we're living in a world that is a synthesis of Will Eisner's world and Milton Glaser's world and other visionaries in other forms of graphics and design. But Will was definitely on the short list of people in that conversation. And that's a really important form of relevancy. And that's one that, at least I believe, is going to continue to be more and more powerful as the next few years come through.
Well, and that's what one thing I was going to mention, if you didn't, was the books he did on graphic storytelling that, you know, still all of the principles in there are still principles of graphic storytelling that any artist or writer or, you know, comics creator can follow. And he was a teacher at the School of Visual Arts, and he taught lots of people who went on to be in the industry, you know, their skills, and so it's hard to know what relevance and influence came out of that. I just happen to know that my husband, Batten Lash, was one of his students, and he, every time we would see Will, and Batten would give him the latest issue of his comic Supernatural Law, you know, Will would look through, and he'd already be saying, okay, this panel configuration is good, but I like that. But here, now, you remember, you leave something off at the end of the page, and really there should be some final thing at the end of the page that's satisfying to the, you know. And so he was still being a teacher 20 years later. And in one case, Batten specifically did a whole issue in an Eisner style. And when he showed it to Will, went, I really like these layouts that you did here. This really, you know, I'm really impressed with what you're doing. And he said, well, I kind of borrowed from you. Well, always borrow from the best. That's what I was saying.
Yeah, we might not turn him always for humility.
Well, compared to a few other people. The other thing that I was like, when Will would be walking around the hall, in the exhibit hall, and, you know, people would timidly come up to him and go, you know, Mr. Eisner, you know, I love your stuff and you've influenced me so much. And, you know, a lot of the long time, you know, big names in comics will say, well, yes, you know, thank you, I am, you know. But he would go, oh, do you do art? Do you draw? Do you have something with you? Can I look at it? And he would turn it back and be interested in what they were doing. And that always impressed me, that was just part of being Will.
Will, I think, always looked out for his students. I've worked at various points in my career. I've been lucky enough to work with an artist named Barry Caldwell, who's a terrific cartoonist and a storyboard artist. And he and I worked on a short comic story together that had a character of mine. And he did a wonderful job on it, really beautiful. And he brought it up to Will at the convention to show it to him. And, you know, like anybody showing it to the master, he's a little hesitant. Will looked it over and he goes, oh, it's really nice. It's funny. And he goes, it's good, but where's yours? I mean, you know, you did this, and this is, you know, that's your artwork. It's, but where's your character? I mean, you know, it's like, I want to see you doing this. And Paul did his thing, and you made it look really good. And, you know, you should be grateful, and I was. But let's see you get your characters out there. So he was always like, with his students, to push them a little better, not only as artists, but to, I think, find the fulfillment he did in creating and guiding the destinies of his own characters.
So we're starting to diverge here into personal qualities, which I think is really appropriate when we're talking about Will. I always found him, just as a human being, to be a terrific role model. He displayed what I can only describe as relentless curiosity. He couldn't walk through these halls slowly. He couldn't walk through them without wanting to understand what was going on in each corner, what different people were doing, why they were doing it, without thinking about what the picture of all of that was. So maybe we can talk for a moment, having all had relationships with the man, about how we've taken some of the lessons from him into our own work and the work we pass on either to our students or our younger protégés or just the people we interact with on a regular basis. Maggie, we missed you on the last round, so let's stick you with the first burden on this one.
Well, one of the things that Don and I observed and appreciated, Will being an outstanding example, is how a professional treats the fans. and that he always had time to respond. He always tried to do a one-on-one. And he appreciated, because of his business aspects, he appreciated aspects of other people that some creatives might not so much. So, for example, and this is a sort of digression from your question, but years ago at a trade show, the Eisner Awards having been established for creativity, he stopped down at me. He said, "Would you mind having breakfast with me? I'd like to bounce an idea off you." "Oh yeah, sure, right." "No, we don't want to have breakfast with you." Yeah. But his point was, he said, it's all very well to acknowledge the stories, but what about the people selling the stories? He said, there needs to be an award for the retailer as well, because the industry would not exist the way it is today without bringing attention to those stores that are giving us our living. What do you think about the idea of having a retailing award? So the fact that he didn't just stop with going, "Huh, I have an award, and I'm something." And by the way, remember the year that he was nominated for an Eisner Award?
There were several times, and he won a couple.
But he was always thinking about something more, something else, something to expand it. How can we tweak this to be even better than it is? I think that was not responsive, but I wanted to get that out there.
I think it is a fair response to me, because there were a couple of pieces in that anecdote that you told that I take away from it. One, that you pointed to the fact that he kept trying to make things better, which is absolutely the case. But the second was, he was unembarrassed to ask openly, "Is this a good idea?" You know, he didn't, this wasn't a case that you had no control over whether or not this award would exist. You weren't a power broker, however you want to define it in the equation. You were someone who was deeply knowledgeable about the field. And he had no problem sort of saying, "Hey, I had an idea. What do you think? Can you make it better? Do you think it's a reasonable idea? What could or should we do with it?" And that's a really good quality to take away as a lesson.
Well, and speaking of the Eisner Awards, originally the Eisner Awards were a plaque. So it was just a nice little plaque you could put on your wall. And around, I don't know, 2000, 2001, we, you know, were approached by trophy companies, "Why don't you do something, you know, a little different?" And so we had a designer trying to come up with what a physical Eisner Award would be. So, you know, of course I consulted Will, and he says, "Okay, number one, I don't want my picture on it. I don't want the spirit on it. I want something that represents comics being international. Comics aren't just an American thing. The awards will be American awards, but this is a communication, a medium that, you know, has fantastic people doing it all over the world." So speaking of understanding comics, I was going through that, and Scott McCloud had this globe with divided into panels, and in one panel had a word balloon in it, and, you know, so they were kind of universal symbols from comics in it. And I said, you know, you want to do something with a globe but then has some kind of comics theme to it. And it ended up being too busy to try to put symbols in it, but it ended up being a globe with divided into panels. And that ended up being the final award. But that was his attitude, is that this is, you know, you want to be as encompassing and broad as possible, because he always thought that, I mean, we've just tapped the surface of comics as a medium of what you can do with it. And, you know, the Eisner Awards are getting the word out about, you know, some of the really good stuff that's being done, and maybe that encourages more people to do it, because they might get an award, but they should be rewarded just because they're doing the thing they want to do. But I don't know if that answers exactly what you were asking, but
I think it's another piece of the puzzle. You're adding the fact that his worldview was broader than most of ours, and I suffer from the fact that I like a couple of particular flavors of comics. I'm really pleased that the medium has grown into
as diverse a world as it is now, and when I teach comics, I try to teach it as broadly as I possibly can. But there's a part of me that keeps wanting to go back to, yeah, but you kind of like chocolate and vanilla. You don't need the pistachio. And Will had, whether it was naturally very broad tastes or educated to very broad tastes or just, again, and maybe as a function of that curiosity, a desire to understand all of these different flavors and respect them. And that was a good lesson to take.
Well, if there's one lesson I learned from Will, was on a creative level as a writer, is that there's no such thing as a small story. There's no, we as creators, we all want to do the big Superman Saves the World story, the big Batman fights all his villains story. That's all fun. But when you look at the world and you can take a story about the 5 minutes it takes for a murderer to...
Was it ten minutes?
Ten minutes, that's it. Okay. I read it fast. the 10 minutes between a frightened kid who commits his first murder and then he's found out and how his life... And he tells you this is the last 10 minutes of this boy's life because he makes a horrible mistake and he pays for it with his life. And it's as suspenseful as anything by Alfred Hitchcock as the clock ticks down. And it's... Not everybody can tell that story. Not everybody wants to, but... Nobody can tell it with the same artistry and emotion as Will Eisner. And those were the stories. You know, it was great to see the spirit fighting his enemies and in big adventures. But those little stories, man, they encapsulate the human condition. And especially when you get into something like The Building or A Contract with God. And you look at those stories now and they take a kind of a shorthand. Because you could certainly... use more dialogue or more prose or more exposition, but why? The story is so elegantly told in those simple but powerful strokes that, you know, I pull those books out regularly and read them.
That still is my response to people who say, oh no, I need a huge story arc to tell my story, and Will did it every week and encapsulated it. I think maybe twice he had an extended story, maybe 3 years, maybe a month long. Mm-hmm. Story, but aside from that,
most of them were seven pages or 8 pages at most.
Yep,
and he'd have a clean punchline to that. Maybe there'd be a trailing character or an injury to the spirit that was relevant the following week.
Right,
but he didn't need 1,000 pages to do it. I think another quality that is clear in what we're talking about, but that we haven't hit as the nail on the head, is the issue of aspiration. For a lot of creative people, the limit of your aspirations is, can I get this done by the deadline, get paid, have my editor reasonably happy with it, and dear God, I hope somebody reads it and enjoys it. From a time before pretty much anyone else in the comic book world, was aspiring to the idea that he was doing something that could be viewed as literary and artistic, that there was a higher dimension to what he was doing. I don't think he kidded himself that was a mark that he was hitting every week on the spirit, but that on the good day, on the 10-minute story, or the Gerhard Schnabel story, or Rat-Tat-Tat, the machine gun. You know, there could be a moment where he would both push the limits of the form and do something that could stand as a piece of creative art. When I teach writing, one of the questions that I ask my students early on is to think about the distinction between craft and art. When you write as a craft, you're writing to get paid. You're writing generally because it's an assignment or because you're hoping it will turn into an assignment. When you're writing purely for art, you're writing for self-expression. Again, you hope someone will read it. You hope someone will love it. You may also hope someone will get paid for it. It's not impossible for the two things to come together.
Shakespeare's plays were clearly a matter of craft. He was writing to fill seats in the Globe Theater. But they are, by any definition, art, because here it is hundreds of years later, and we're still reading them. Shakespeare's sonnets, on the other hand, I don't think he ever expected to make 10 cents off. They were a form of art, and they have survived as art. Will was unusually gifted at treading the line between craft and art. He never lost sight of craft in, I think, anything that he did. And some of the things that he did were purely craft. Much of the work for the army, for the commercial clients that he worked with. He was telling the story that had a job to do to get paid on Friday. But he transcended the craft many times in the spirit, when it wasn't a natural outcome, and frequently in the graphic novel work, when it was something he was trying to do. The graphic novels, he was aiming for the fences, certainly with Contract God. He aspired to that being taken seriously. And if being taken seriously meant somehow subsidizing the publication in a way that would allow it to be printed in a more sophisticated fashion, getting at the kind of distribution and imprimatur he wanted. The craft virtue of getting paid the most on Friday was really secondary to the artistic goal. That was very, very rare in comics in his generation. And I won't say it's rare today, but it is not. It is still not the commonplace attitude. It's hard to transcend craft. It's hard to transcend the need to get paid on Friday. When you write for a living, you write for a living.
Well, how many people are familiar with The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon? He interviewed Eisner extensively for background for that book, and the character that's most based on Eisner is the guy who thinks that comics are an art form, a medium, that just the way Will did, whereas all the other guys around him, well, I'm only doing comics until I can get real, you know, legitimate. I want to be an illustrator, or I want to do comic strips, but, you know, comic books are the bottom of the barrel, and if I meet people at parties, and that's the last thing I'm going to mention I even work on, whereas, you know, that was not a problem with him, because he thought they were pretty cool. So, one of the best panels I've ever seen at Comic-Con was Will being interviewed by Michael Chabon, and it was a fantastic panel.
Anything else on that one, guys?
That was me saying, wow.
No.
Okay. Apparently, for the Eisner Awards to function perfectly, Ms. Jackie has to exercise her art, because it certainly isn't just craft. Thank you for being with us.
I always love the opportunity to talk about Will.
If there's no time else, we'll see you tomorrow evening.
Yes, under the awards. I actually had someone who said to me, oh, I didn't know just anybody could get into the awards. You know, I didn't know that just the members in the
convention
could attend. And I said, are you kidding?
I don't think that's actually pretty common. That came up like 8 times on Facebook feed.
Okay, well, please tell anyone you meet that any and all are welcome. There are not 6,500 seats in the ballroom where the awards take place. But on the other hand, we don't expect anyone to sleep outside to get in there.
Right. Well, and the weird thing is, if you're a comics fan, this is where the professionals come, and you can hang out.
Jackie, Miss guarding the door, can you, someone shriek out there and see if you can, thank you. She can juggle 4,000 people for the awards, get actors to get on stage and do their routines, get all the little statues handed out. Sometimes she can't remember her bag, but we love her dearly. Okay. There's another level, I think, to the issue of relevance. One of the other things that I do is teach a lot these days. It's kind of a version of the old joke. Mine is those who no longer can do teach.
Move too quickly. I'm sorry.
You got her on the cell?
I'm working at it.
Okay, Maggie is going to hunt her down.
Well, no, I've got her email. Great. Thanks, Jackie. I do not.
We will find her. We will hunt her down. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Keep going.
Yeah. Lost it somewhere.
Those we no longer can do.
Oh, yeah. So what I'm teaching, what I find academics try to do, real academics, I'm a faux academic as a teacher, they're very focused on tracing back sort of the family tree of developments. When exactly is it that the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnons branch off from the human beings? People working in the craft of comics aren't particularly focused on who invented a technique first. You know, this is what we do. This is how we do it. But there's a relevance to the academic process, to understanding how a medium develops, to look back on when something started, who started it, why did it start that way? What was there about that moment in time that caused that development to happen? And Paul, maybe you can point to something that you think you look back on in Will's work and say, this is where I saw the branch of comics evolution going off in a new direction.
Well, I think it was for me, it was the Signal from Space story. It was a fantastic idea about Earth being contacted by extraterrestrials, told in comic book form. And by, at least that's ostensibly what it was about, and by the second issue I knew that we would not see any aliens or space battles or anything like that, but it was a very human story, all Earth-based, about the effect of hearing extraterrestrial signals coming to Earth and how that affected people on a very human, on a very gut-wrenching level, about who tries to take, the politicians who try and take advantage of it, the people who believe it, the cult feeling around it. That at first I was a little disappointed that we wouldn't see aliens, and then I realized you don't want to see them. You want to see the effect on people. It's almost like the confirmation. I think he was doing almost a parable of what if you had proof that God exists but you don't see him, and how does that affect people, and how does the world react to something like that? And it was such a human story that when I was reading it, even at the time I was thinking, like, why isn't this a TV series? Why isn't this like a TV movie or a miniseries? Because it has that richness to it. And it has that great sense of mystery that a lot of terrific science fiction and very human stories, especially ones that have their genesis and things from the 50s and earlier, it all seemed very fresh to me. And in a way, kind of disturbing, because it was such a human story and it was such a visceral story in so many ways. But I thought it was tremendous, and it just showed me that you can do a story like this with tremendous artwork, with great characterization, and it's just as vital in art form as movies, but it's different because it comes from a different place. It's a wonderful way of telling a story, and there are times in my own writing when I think, should this be a script or a TV show? And I think, no, it really should be a comic, because the comic, you can tell stories like that in a comic format, in a comic book format, and it's just as vital and as important a medium as film, I truly love working in that form, and owe it all to the maturity of Will Eisner's writing.
Thank you.
Maggie?
I'd also point out one of the, and now I'm going to be off topic because I got distracted, but I'd like to point out the immediate kindness that Will had in terms of communicating with his fans. So he didn't treat the fans differently. I did an article. I did not grow up reading the Spirit. If you did not get the Spirit sections in your newspaper, you never saw the Spirit. Unless you got, like, there were about three reprint comics and then it was gone. I had never seen it. So when Don showed me the Spirit, I'm going, oh, my gosh, this is tremendous. I ended up doing the article on the first big published article on the Spirit. And his response was very personal to me. And it wasn't a thanks for doing it. I made fun of the fact that the Spirit didn't wear socks in the comics. And so I made a big point. So it was like, you know, the blue hat, the blue mask, what about the socks? And his response was to send to me a piece of art that said it was sort of the Spirit going, grr, you know, this was a joke on the part of the colorist. I always had socks. And I think it might even be in the program book because I scanned that so that would be available. That was his first response to, out of the blue, who cares, fan writing about this character. And he always gave that feedback. He always, if you had a question, he would answer the question. If you sent him a letter, he would respond to the letter. And a man as busy as he was, that's jaw-dropping.
Cool. I would add that if you look back on some of the earliest Spirits, you see some of the first experiments with what a comic book page can be. Mm-hmm. And when we go back and we trace that historically, there are some roots in the newspaper strip, but not quite. Most of the experimental work there, whether it's done by McKay or some of the other greats of the time, are very specific to the kind of page they're working on in the newspaper. It's the color dripping down from the dreams. Will goes in and it's sort of, this story can be served this way. And you start seeing that, okay, so we're going to move from traditional panels to freeform using type here. We're going to move to a cutaway view of the house and have our characters move through the house as we tell the story. Those are all commonplace gimmicks now. And you put them in a comic, nobody gets excited. Okay, they're using trick number 72. But it does matter to be able to look back and see where these tricks came from, when 72 went into the trick book, and who put it there. Maybe more for the academics than for the practitioners of the field, but that's part of how you figure out the evolution of things. And particularly to Paul's reaction, I think, Will was very specifically thought of in his own time and generation as one of the people who was bringing the logic of film onto the comic book page. That, again, that's commonplace now. And vice versa. The film guys certainly have learned enough from many of the comic creators. Certainly, if you try to define our other centennial of the convention, Jack Kirby's influence, I would argue that Kirby's contribution to culture that's as important as his work on the characters he created is, I think, he created a visual of action dynamics that really permeates the whole culture we have. The visual way storytelling is done in video games and in cinema today is very much a child of Jack Kirby's work. Well, when we look at how a comic book story is told on the page, whether it's told with Eisner's line, whether it's told as an Eisner-type human story, the grammar of storytelling is very much Will's.
One of the points that I will be making at the Eisner Awards that hit me as I was analyzing this centenary moment is Jack Kirby and Will Eisner did not grow up reading comic books. They didn't go to the newsstand on the corner and get picture stories. There were some reprints of the strips, but the format of the comic book and the existence of the comic book was not anything they had when they were kids. They had to invent that art form with others, to a new art form out of the brains of these geniuses. 100 years ago, no comic books. 100 years from now, who the heck knows?
Speaking to what Paul was saying, if you analyze Eisner's work in regards to film, there's an argument to be made that the way that Will used his layouts, the way that a film director would use music to weave a through line for the story and to bring emotional power to the elements. Because if you look at the way he approached a page layout, you can hear a sort of invisible
crescendo.
Yeah. Almost in an audible music, if that makes sense, as your eye goes from emotional beat to drama to comedy. And
a great way of putting it.
Thank you.
We have time, I think, for a couple of questions, if there are any from the audience.
Rich,
if you want to go up to the mic just so that it gets picked up by a couple of people who are recording, that would be wonderful. I know everybody's tired by this time of day at the convention, but...
I just wanted to comment on your characterization of it being an academic pursuit to sort of go back and look at stuff. Because I find that it's very inspirational to go back there, that the form has developed along a certain line. And sometimes by going back to those roots creatively, you'll say, hey, this was something that was not pursued at some point. But I can use that in my story. So whether it's looking back at old movies, silent movies or things like that, or looking back at Eisner's work, there are things that can stir the creative juices and give you a new point of view at looking at things. So that's the relevance that I see as being really important.
Great comment. Thank you.
One of the things that, when I look at the work, is some of the timelessness we talked about with William Shakespeare, but in some of the ideas that are being made, in some of the things that are almost like the bubble in terms of the old Eastern European Jews or the tenements and the things that existed, but how relevant what's happening, that struggle and that weird struggle continues to be. So I have somebody I know who came to this country only 3 years ago from China and found, contract with God to be very relevant. So it's all about the struggle and how to move. And so one of the things that I think Mr. Eisner's work did was transform those things, those personal stories, in a way that people could read them and read them and see themselves in them. And I think that's part of the legacy that he can leave.
Good comment. Good comment as well.
What can we do as a whole to keep the works and ideas of Will Eisner continue to be relevant and also easily introduced to new generations?
Well, I think the starting point in that is the same for Will as it is for any great creative work that we've appreciated. It's to pass it on. Whether that's to teach it, which is certainly meaningful, and it's sometimes a challenge, right? It's not as easy to get a classroom of college students excited about Contract with God as it is to get them excited about Fun Home, because Fun Home feels more about the world that they're living in and has reference points that are more common to them. But to give it context and to try to introduce it to them. Or whether it's by, over the course of your life, buying 5 or 6 copies and handing them to people. Many of us have, over the years, had a favorite book or a favorite record or a favorite movie that we just made sure somebody saw. This will matter to you. It matters to you because I think it has some resonance to this moment in your life. It matters to you because you're interested in exploring this form. And give it to a person when they're young. I think the other piece of the dynamic, it's Sam Moskowitz who gets attributed, I think, most often, the line, the golden age of science fiction is 12. I'm not sure it's ever... Did they ever find if that was his?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't know. We specified that with comic books and popularized it, but I don't think we had an origin. We didn't have Google to check it with them, so...
Let's not settle for the Google version.
Yeah.
But it is true that we imprint young, and the things that are exposed to us, maybe it's at 12, maybe later, whether it's the music we listen to or the foods that we eat, the comfort foods that were introduced in our family, the writers who were first exposed to in certain forms, matter more to us. And I think one of the first best things you can do is, whether it's Signal from Space or Contract with God or
PS Magazine, how are you going to field strip a Jeep?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It might have helped.
There are Militaria people who would be fascinated by that.
Yeah. I don't know if it would have convinced me to be a car guy. I still don't think I could figure out how to field strip a Jeep. But maybe give it to a guy going into the forces.
Well,
or gal.
I actually will say that Chet Krause, who did Old Cars Weekly, when we were doing Comics Buyer's Guide, he died last year, and one of the things that happened was he passed on to me his collection of PS. He said, well, I think you would like it. So that's the thing, is you spread it to whatever the contact is to somebody, whatever is going to light that match for that person, it's something to take advantage of.
And you can also gift things to libraries.
Mm-hmm.
It's an expensive thing to buy a set of the Spirit Archives, but it's a wonderful thing to give that to a university library. That's not because Will lived in an era of stereotyping that mercifully is no longer acceptable. You can't give that to a junior high school audience easily. High school audience is a little challenging. College audience, absolutely suitable for study. Give the work. And again, I think this is a great question for more than Will Eisner. I think that's a form of paying it forward. And it's one of the things we can do for any of the creative people whose work have inspired and touched us.
One of the ways that I've introduced people to Will Eisner, particularly younger readers, they did a great collection of his holiday stories, The Christmas Spirit.
Hmm.
And that is some people who... young readers who wouldn't have necessarily picked up what looked like a detective comic book, they thought, oh, this is sort of cute. There are these little holiday stories, and that Will had a particular affinity for them, and that is a nice intro into it. Like, you might want to give somebody a mixtape of holiday music that has Zydeco and Western Swing, and those are types of music that they wouldn't have checked out before, but because there's a theme, it is an easier pill to swallow.
I think we can take one more question, and then they're going to shoot us. Anybody? Yeah?
Maggie, pardon me if this is already going to ask, but on the recent NPR survey of great graphic novels, they specifically said they did not include Will because of aspects of the work which were not inappropriate then. How did you feel about that?
I commented that if the only thing Will Eisner had done was Contract with God, his work would probably not be in that list of 100 comics, which, by the way, I recommend. Do NPR 100 comics. The idea was to find something that would appeal to as many different formats of comics, as many different types of comics as potential comics buffs would enjoy. And I was arguing for The Spirit, and one of the members, okay, so don't tell anybody, that one of the conversations of us as curators, one of the curators said, every time she saw Ebony, it felt like she was punched in the gut. And the point being that she wanted to, our goal was to share things that people would enjoy. And if it was really possible that it would distress the readers, that's not the goal that we were after in this particular project. And we said Contract with God is a wonderful introduction to the work of Will Eisner, and that we hoped others would go and explore, and then as adults, yes, expand and find all the wonders of his work. But that was a problem, and it was a problem I raised in my first article on the spirit years ago, and he addressed it later brilliantly. First in New York Herald Tribune. He did a spirit story for the New York Herald Tribune, what happened to Ebony later. And I believe he becomes a member of the...
He worked with the city government.
City government, yes.
I mean, I think addressing the Ebony question head on, to me the relevant thing is that when Will begins the spirit, he's in his early 20s, he's essentially lived a life that's been bounded by a largely Jewish immigrant population. He said, if he's had any conversations with any people of color more complicated than, you know, I'm shining shoes on this corner, you're selling newspapers on this corner, you think the Yankees are going to win today, I would be surprised. By the time he comes back from the war, he's a more mature adult. He does some things to try to make his depiction of Ebony better, and he introduces some people of color in more fully rounded, more human roles. It's challenging giving someone that early material to read without saying this is a creature of its time. In many ways, it is some of the most brilliant material of its time, but it is of its time. The guy I co-teach with at Columbia, Jeremy Dauber, who's a comics scholar as well as, of all things, a Yiddish professor. He tries not to teach too much Yiddish. Propounds, for conversational purpose, the Dauber rule. What is it we do now that 20 years from now the next generation will come back and say, what kind of horrible human beings were they to blank? And you know there's something on that list. And I'm not sure whether it's the amount of meat that we eat. Lots of people here are already more civilized, let's say, than I am on that issue. How we treat each other in one fashion or another. But the world has been getting, in many ways, progressively better. The last 6 months, perhaps, aside. And hopefully that will continue. And you look back on Will's work, and yes, we're a better world in some ways than we were then. But for the world that he created that material in, the flaws are normal. And the triumphs are very, very unusual. I think we have to go now. I'd like to thank Jackie for that with us. She certainly does invite you all to the Eisner Awards, Maggie, Paul, and all of you. Do keep the legacy alive, not just for Will, but of all of the creators whose magic has brought us to this hall. The convention is great to devote so much of its souvenir book to Will and Jack. There's a piece in there that I wrote on Shelley Mayer, who also would turn 100 this year, who was one of our great founding creators of the field. The half-life is overtaking these guys. And keep the memories alive, because you love their work or you wouldn't be in this room. Tell somebody about it. Thank you all.